Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me from a long distance is my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Yes, and we had snow a couple a week ago or so, but now it's looking like spring. The trees are blooming, and there's flowers blooming, and spring's coming.
I'm glad to hear that because I am actually heading back to Iowa.
I know.
It's a little bit, I'm a little nervous about it, but, the traveling during this time.
Right.
But anyway, I'm doing it because I need to get back home. I've been gone almost 8 weeks and I feel like things have settled down enough and I can wear a mask and there won't be anyone else sitting near me on the plane and I'll be good. But we have an exciting book today, don't we? I know.
That we were
both very enthused about this book.
Well, it is. It's called, excuse me, The Henna Artist, and is that what it's called?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And not only did I not know what that was, but I was not familiar with the culture of India, which is where it's set, and this book is just. The way she presented it, because I can't tell you about the author.
Yes, please do.
Alka Joshi, and she is a graduate of Stanford University and received her MFA from the California College of the Arts. She has worked as an advertising and copywriter, a marketing consultant, and illustrator. She was born in India, and her family came to the United States when she was 9, and she now lives in California, Monterey, Pennsylvania, with her husband and 2 misbehaving pups. Okay. Okay. So, I believe, that you said it took you 10 years to write this book?
Yes. It took me 10 years. And, if you had said to me, first of all, when I was 20 or 30 or 40, one day you're going to write a novel, I would have said, you're just dreaming. And when I actually sat down to write it, if you had told me it would take you 10 years to finish this novel, I would have said, you're dreaming. But guess what? Nobody was dreaming about any of that. Even my mentor in my MFA program, Anita Amirezvani, when I asked her how long it took her to write the book that I absolutely loved, called The Blood of Flowers, which I loved so much that I followed her to this CCA MFA program. When she told me that it took her 9 years to finish the first book, I remember thinking to myself, that was just her experience. It's not going to be my experience. I'm going to be so much faster. There's no way. And you know what? It just takes as long as it takes because, it's like with anything else that you want to get really good at. You have to put in the time. You have to put in the effort that it takes to do something over and over and over, right? I'm sure that the two of you, Monica and Caroline, I'm sure that you have something that you love to do that you're passionate about. Maybe it's sewing. Maybe it's gardening. Whatever it is, it takes hours, right, to get better at it.
Well, that's true. Even doing the show, when we first started in 2006, and we were doing a live show at that point. Now we're recording, but we were doing a live show at KRUU, which was a local community radio station. And I would write out all the questions ahead of time. Uh-huh. I'd send them to the authors of potential questions that we were going to ask. Mom was It was a little easier for her because she had done radio interviews for how many years already at that point?
Since 73, something like that.
Yeah.
So, wow.
Yeah. So she had been doing it for a while, but for me it was all new. And now it's really a lot easier, isn't it? At least for
right.
me it is.
Right. And also authors like to tell us about their book and everything and how they wrote it, and that's they really get going, and it really helps. It helps us.
Yeah. And, ladies, one of the things that I think I want people to take heart, your listeners should take heart about, is that I was 51 when I started this project, and now I'm 62. And one of the things that I thought is, well, I'm so old. Like, am I, you know, why am I trying to do this at this stage of my life? Well, you know what? At any stage of your life, you can reinvent yourself. So now I feel like I've reinvented myself as a novelist. It may have taken me 10 years, but it was worth the trip. And I'm so glad I did it at this age, because at this age, I can write about grief and loneliness and sadness and death and birth when I couldn't have written about it in my 20s. I didn't have the experience. And all of your listeners, yeah, and all of your listeners with this kind of experience can actually, they have experiences that they've accumulated. They have these things that have happened to them in their lives that they can talk about, which, you know, you can't talk about when you're just 20 and just starting out in life.
Mm-hmm. Once you've lived through it, then you can write about it. That's right.
That is a really good point. That's a wonderful thing. You know, I've been writing myself off and on over the years, but always other things got in the way, and I keep thinking I'll get back to it someday. And it's good to know that maybe I'm not too old to do that. I didn't think that I was.
Yeah.
But you're a wonderful, wonderful example. What were you doing in the earlier iterations of yourself?
Well, let's see. I started off, I was an auditor in my early years.
Okay. I'm an accountant. Really. I'm an accountant, so there you go.
There you go. And then I thought, you know, I've always been an artist. I've always been drawing or painting. Let me go into something more creative. And so I finally decided, okay, I think what I'm going to do is go into advertising, because that satisfies a lot of my needs. I get to be creative. I get to also learn about advertising, about doing commercials, about doing radio ads. And I was always fascinated as an immigrant kid growing up, by the way, in Iowa.
Seriously? Where in Iowa?
Yeah. We were in Ames because my father was getting his doctorate at Iowa State University.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so, you know, as a kid growing up as an immigrant, I was fascinated by commercials because it's the best way for an immigrant to learn about the culture of their new country. Right? You learn idioms. You learn what is trendy. You learn, you know, what people are wearing and what they're saying. And so I just absorbed all of that. And so did my brothers. We just absorbed advertising like crazy. So I just thought, you know what? I think what I want to do is advertising. So I put together a portfolio. I went out to the biggest ad agencies in San Francisco because I knew I wanted to work on really big accounts. I wanted to work in TV. And the only way you can work on big TV accounts is to go to a big city and work at the big agencies. So I went around, and a portfolio piece that I sent out ahead of time said, it was an appeal supposedly for my older brother, and it said, please interview my sister. She wants a job in advertising, but she has forgotten to get married and have children, and so we need for her to get busy with something. Please interview her. And you would not believe it. Out of the six portfolio interview requests that I sent out, I got four interviews.
Oh,
people were like, who is this crazy chick? So I got a job with McCann Erickson finally. And so I start doing advertising, and I loved doing radio commercials and TV commercials because that's when I really got to have a voice. And what I was really doing is writing mini stories. Stories that only lasted a minute, stories that only lasted 20 seconds. But I learned how to do a very short form of creating an atmosphere and a scene in a short period of time. So I took that information and I started my own agency. And I thought, you know what? I know enough people in the business now that I could just hire freelancers, but I'll be the creative director. I'll be actually coming up with ideas and working with my team to make these things happen. So that's what I was doing. I had been running my agency for 20 years at the time that I enrolled in my first in the MFA program for creative writing in San Francisco.
Now, you mentioned that you had a mentor whose book drew you to that program. But why did you think that you needed to go to an MFA program in order to write this book?
That's an excellent question, because a lot of people don't actually need to go through an MFA program. But the year was 2008. And do you remember what happened in 2008? Remember what was happening with the economy?
Yes, I do. It was not everything as bad changed as what's happening right now.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
But yeah, everything changed.
Everything changed. The mortgage industry just totally brought everything down. And so my phone stopped ringing in my business. And I was talking to a friend and she said, you know, the opportunity cost of going to graduate school has never been lower. So I was thinking about that and I thought, yeah, you know what? I could just enroll in a program, and I wanted the intensity of a 2-year program where I did nothing but focus on the writing, nothing. And I think that is what the MFA program allows you to do. You are immersed in writing, in reading about writing, in learning about crafts that are related, like poetry, like essays. And you're talking about writing all the time with your classmates, with your teachers. So it is just a way to immerse yourself in that world and be very intense for 2 years. And that is where I started writing The Henna Artist. That became my thesis. Now, during that time, also a fantastic thing happened. My mother was living with my husband and me. She had some health issues. And so we found a place where she had a garden apartment. She lived below us, and then we lived upstairs. And at the same time, my younger brother bought a condo in Jaipur. And so Mom was feeling nostalgic. She wanted to reconnect with her old friends, with her girlhood. So I would take her, I would chaperone her back to Jaipur. She might spend 3 months there. I would spend a month there. I would come back, and then my younger brother would maybe go and get her towards the end of her trip. I did that 4 times during that 2-year period that I was in my MFA program, because as you know, when you're in college, you get these long breaks in between sessions. Mm-hmm. And I got to spend time with my mom in a way that I hadn't before. And maybe you two, being a mother-daughter team, kind of understand this. But at some point, you stop looking at your mom as just a mother, and you start seeing her as a person, as an individual, as somebody with their own desires and their own ideas about maybe what they wanted to be. And I started seeing that about my mom. And we talked a lot during those periods that we were together in India. And so I wrote major scenes while I was with her in India. I was in that environment. I was smelling the fragrances. I was eating the food. I was talking to the people there, everything from shopkeepers to the principals of schools. And so the scenes came alive for me during that time. I would read them to my mom, and my mom said, "Honey, this is really good. Keep going."
Now, before that, had you been to India much before this time with your mother?
You know, I had been back a couple of times, and my parents were very, I think, very different from other immigrant parents who may go back to their homeland maybe every couple of years or maybe every year. I heard about Indian families that go back every year. Now, I didn't live in that kind of a family. Both my parents were very progressive in the sense that once we got here to America, they really felt that assimilation was the key to our new country. And so they encouraged us to do everything American, to talk in English all the time, even at home. They encouraged us to go to different religious orders that like our friends would attend. So, you know, our friends would say, "Hey, let's go to the synagogue. Hey, you know, can you join us, my family, for church, Catholic church this coming Sunday. So, you know, they helped us to just explore our new world in a way that I think maybe a lot of families don't, because they're afraid that they might lose their traditional values. But my parents didn't feel like that.
Well, how fortunate for you that they
had
the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, and you know, growing up in Iowa, I think was really interesting for that, because, you know, back in 1967, when we first arrived in Ames, people hadn't seen, the people who lived there had not seen a lot of Indians like us, right? Mm-hmm. And so it behooved us to really acclimate ourselves to that culture than for them to acclimate themselves to our culture, right? I mean, it really is, I think it was very important for us to learn how to be Americans. And I think Iowa was a great starting point for that. And then my father got his first job in St. Louis, Missouri. So we lived there for a year. And then we lived in Kansas City, Kansas. And that was when my brothers and I all went to middle school, high school, and then we went off to different places for college after that.
Was there even an Indian restaurant in Ames when you first got there?
No. No, there wasn't. And I remember
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody loves Indian food, right? Mm-hmm. When you read The Henna Artist, don't you just want to go to an Indian restaurant? Don't you just want to eat food? Because I mentioned so much food in the book. You cannot think about India without thinking about Indian cuisine. And so what would happen is, okay, when we first got here, my mother, even though she had learned English in India and she had, she knew how to read English, she didn't speak a lot of English. And so she would take me along when she went grocery shopping and she would say, okay, ask them for cilantro. And, our Indian names are things like ask for pudina, ask for dhania, you know, ask for mirch. And so I would have to translate these words into English for the shopkeepers. And it was so hard to find so many of these ingredients because they weren't even available. And so my mom had to improvise a lot because we still ate a lot of Indian food at home.
And of course, it would be easier to find those things now.
Turmeric,
for example, you know, not too hard to find turmeric now, but probably not in 1967.
No, but you know, all of those spices now are being recognized in the West as being so helpful to people's health. My father, to this day, every night before he goes to bed, he will mix some turmeric in milk and drink it because it's really good for joint pain. It's really good for digestion. And a lot of the foods that we cook with the spices are really good for your digestion, just for your overall health. And don't you feel that everyone around the country now sort of recognizes the benefits of cumin, let's say, and eating more onion, garlic, fenugreek and turmeric. And, you know, we have this thing called garam masala, which is actually a combination of three or four different spices that, you know, you just add a little bit of flavor to the food. And boy, it just tastes so fantastic.
Well, yes. And of course, Ayurvedic medicine, Ayurvedic healing things that are a lot. I mean, the henna artist, your character Lakshmi, knows all these traditional herbal remedies for things that, you're right, are becoming much more well-known now, particularly in Fairfield, Iowa, which is where I live when I'm not in Texas, which is the home of the Maharishi International University and Maharishi Ayurvedic Products, MAPI. So it's, you know, I have a friend who carries a churna around with him to put on every meal, to put on every dish, because it has the six tastes. All six tastes are combined in this churna.
Oh, how wonderful.
So, yeah, it's very familiar to me. And your characters certainly drink a lot of chai.
Yes.
Which
because once again, and once again, chai is infused with so many spices. There's cardamom, which is very calming. It's a very calming spice. And, you know, as you know, it comes from a little seed. And the seed is either ground and put into the chai, or you can put whole cardamom seeds in chai. Then also there's cinnamon. So the entire cinnamon bark can go into a pot of chai. Then also there's black pepper, which is really good for your sinuses and just your respiratory area. And then the very last thing that a lot of people add is a little bit of ginger, which is good for your stomach. So even chai, you know, like even the making of something like tea turns into a whole spice fest.
Absolutely. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Alka Joshi, author of The Henna Artist. So, Mom, what drew you into this book?
Well, I opened the book, and I'm thinking, gosh, I bet there's going to be some names I won't know how to pronounce. But the thing is, she has a glossary of the people in order of appearance in the book and who they are and what they have to do with the story in some cases, which helped tremendously. And then in the back, that's in the front, and then in the back she has, oh gosh, where can I find it?
Glossary.
Glossary of all these names of things. So, I mean, it made it so much easier to read and so much more interesting. And I just, oh gosh, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book. First of all, of course, it was a page turner, but that's why I went to start to read it again, because I kind of forgotten about the first part.
And can I tell you, Caroline, this is so interesting because, you know, what I did was I wanted to imagine a life for my mother had she not had an arranged marriage, or if she had had an arranged marriage, how she might have fared if she had abandoned that arranged marriage and gone off and done something completely different. Well, what would she have done? Oh, she's so creative. She's so talented and artistic. She could have been a henna artist. Okay, well, then how would she have convinced people to hire her? How would she have gotten inside these homes? And so, you know, as I imagined all these things, what I was really imagining was my mother, who did have an arranged marriage. My parents were arranged in 1955 in India, which is when the novel starts taking place. And these two people come together. But in my book, you know, this is where writers get to take a lot of creative license, right? My father was not abusive towards my mother, but I had to figure out some way to get the main character, Lakshmi, away from this marriage. And so I made her husband abusive. Well, he's abusive, and she has to figure out some way to get out of that situation. How is she going to do it? How is she going to run away from this small village and go up into the big city? So I think that is what you're alluding to when you say it's kind of a page turner, because you're like, well, how, you know, where's she going to go next? And what's going to happen next? And as we start the novel, Lakshmi is 30 years old. She's been at this now for 13 years as a very prized henna artist. She is about to build her first house. This has like been a big dream of hers. And she's going to ask her parents to come live with her to make up for the fact that she deserted this marriage 13 years ago. Well, who should show up at her door but this terrible husband? And he says, oh, I finally found you. Hey, and by the way, I have brought with me a sister you didn't even know you had. She's 13 years old, and she is ripe for the taking. And, you know, she needs to learn a few things. So why don't you take her in hand? And so now suddenly Lakshmi, who felt like she was on the cusp of her greatest success, is burdened with two parts of her family that she hadn't even imagined she'd be a part of, and also that she doesn't want to take care of. But she, because she is resourceful and because she's intelligent, she figures out some way that she can deal with both of these new intruders into her life.
Well, the fact that she has so much empathy for people, too, makes her realize that this young woman, you know, she's lost her parents because both of them died. And so she felt alone. And then, gosh, I got an older sister. So then she could, you know, I mean, it's amazing. It really is. And that her husband, well, I'm not going to be a spoiler, because but I thought he was an interesting character too.
Yeah. And he has a interesting trajectory throughout the novel too. I think, you know, one of the things that makes characters come to life for people is that they have things happen in their lives that change their personalities, that change their way of looking at the world. You know, it sort of follows our patterns, our real life patterns. We change throughout our lives. We have
experiences that happen to us that change our view of the world. And if we can read about characters for whom that also happens, we can suddenly relate to that character. So always in writing, what you want to do is to create a character that other people can empathize with, that other people can go, oh, I've been there, or yes, I totally get that. I would have been sad in that situation too. I would have felt like that in that situation too.
That's right. That's right. Well, you really nailed it, I'll tell you, in this book.
Had just reading partners who helped. I had people in my classes who gave me feedback. My own husband gave me feedback. My father gave me really good feedback because he, of course, was involved in the independence movement in India and then was married. And then, you know, he and my mom were there post-independence. He was one of the people who responded to Prime Minister Nehru's call for young men to become engineers and to help rebuild India. So you see, I had firsthand knowledge of what that era must have felt like, what that must have felt like for all of the people who were living there. So Dad gave me a lot of fabulous information and firsthand information on the Maharaja, the Maharani, you know, so many of the people that he had known while he was there. So writing is, yeah, so you know, I was just going to finish by saying writing is a collaborative effort, and that so many people have helped me round these characters out so that they became whole characters with multidimensional personalities.
I had a teacher when I was in junior high who admired Mahatma Gandhi so much that she was always talking about him and always telling us about things like this and think of his life and, you know, what happened in India. And then I could remember that as I was reading this, remember about her. She was a history teacher. And he had a lot of great quotes that have persevered through the years. And so, you know, he must have been really something.
Yes, and one of the quotes that I mentioned in this novel is, "An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind."
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, I tried to infuse as much of what was actually happening in India at the time into the novel. And remember, you know, this is post-independence, right? So the independence stuff has already happened. The partition's already taken place. A lot of people have been displaced. But here in Jaipur, in Rajasthan, much of life stayed the same because, you know, this is, if let's say Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas are the sort of heart of America, then Rajasthan is really the heart of the Maharajas, the Maharanis, that whole era of these fiefdoms that were then dismantled after independence. So there is still a lot left of royalty in the area, but there's also this whole feeling of people thinking, well, we have our country back, we have our lands back, we have the opportunity to grow and to be different than we were before.
How did the people, how did the common people feel about the people who thought they were royalty or who were royalty at one time? How did they feel about them?
You know, I think that they have they're of two minds about it. And I think it's similar to how Britain feels about their royalty. On the one hand, you're really proud that there is this royal person who represents you. They are beautiful. They are finely attired. They are well fed. They represent your area well. But on the other hand, you sort of resent the fact that maybe they have their wealth on the backs of the people who are actually laboring the area as fertile as it is. So I think they're of two minds about it.
Alka, did your mother know that she was the inspiration for Lakshmi in your novel?
Yes, she did. Yes, she did. And, you know, so during that time that she and I were going back and forth to Jaipur, you know, she, I told her, I said, Mom, I'm writing this thing about you. I'm sort of imagining what your life could have been like if you, before the kids came, if you just sort of ran away. And she said, well, this is not really me, Alka. And I said, Dina, you know, but I said, you know, I'm a writer. I you know, I get to imagine things. But Lakshmi in the novel, she looks just like my mother. So my mother had green eyes. My mother had this beautiful hair and this really creamy skin. And even in her later years, like let's say when she was, I think 65, 70, you know, like when I was going back with her and she was in her 70s, when we would go back, people would talk over her in Hindi to other people saying, oh, where's this lady from? Is she from Canada? Is she from America? And Mom would be standing right there and say, hey, I'm Indian too. You know, she would start speaking in Hindi because she didn't look very Indian. And so I have inherited a lot of her look. And so I am constantly being asked, what am I? Am I Brazilian? Am I Italian? Am I Greek? Yeah, all the time.
Do you know where that coloring and the eye coloring, you know, came from?
Oh, you know, the passage that you want me to read is going to explain a little bit
all
about
that. Well, why don't we do that now?
Yeah, good idea.
Excellent. I'm going to start first with the feeling about independence at the time. So this is from chapter one. Jaipur, state of Rajasthan, India, November 15, 1955. Independence changed everything. Independence changed nothing. 8 years after the British left, we now had free government schools, running water, and paved roads. But Jaipur still felt the same to me as it had 10 years ago, the first time I stepped foot on its dusty soil. On our way to our first appointment of the morning, Malik and I nearly collided with a man carrying cement bags on his head when a bicycle cut between us. The cyclist, hugging a 6-foot ladder under his arm, caused a horse carriage to sideswipe a pig, who ran squealing into a narrow alley. At one point, we stepped aside and waited for a Ravan Hijras to pass. The sari-clad, lipstick-wearing men were singing and dancing in front of a house to bless the birth of a baby boy. So accustomed were we to the odors of the city, cow dung, cooking fires, coconut hair oil, sandalwood incense, and urine, that we barely noticed them. What independence had changed was our people. You could see it in the way they stood, chests puffed, as if they could finally allow themselves to breathe. You saw it in the way they walked, purposefully, pridefully to their temples, the way they haggled, more boldly than before, with the vendors in the bazaar. Okay, now I'm going to skip to, so this is Lakshmi and Malik, who are just starting off their day, their regular day of a series of panna appointments, and now they are coming to Parvati's house. Parvati is one of Lakshmi's biggest benefactors and her very first client in Jaipur from 13 years ago.
And Malik is
Malik is her sort of a little boy servant. You know, he carries a lot of her supplies. He haggles with suppliers on her behalf. He's just a really innovative and ingenious kid.
Yes, he is.
Okay, so here she is in Parvati's grand estate. She has come to do Parvati's henna, and here she is thinking while she's doing her henna. Before I came to Jaipur, my ladies relied on women of the Shudra caste to henna their hands and feet. But the low caste Shudra women painted what their mothers had before them. Simple dots, dashes, triangles. Just enough to earn their meager income. My patterns were far more intricate. They told stories of the women I served. My henna paste was finer and silkier than the mixture the Shudra women used. I took care to rub a lemon and sugar lotion into my lady's skin before applying the henna so the imprint would last for weeks. The darker the henna, the more a woman was loved by her husband, or so my clients believed. and my rich cinnamon designs never disappointed. Over time, my clients had come to believe that my henna could bring wayward husbands back to their beds or coax a baby from their wombs. Because of this, I could name a price 10 times higher than the sugar of women and receive it. Even Parvati credited her younger son's birth to my henna skills. She had been my first client in Jaipur. When she conceived, I saw the pages of my appointment book fill up with the ladies of her acquaintance, the elite of Jaipur. Now, as the henna on her hands was drying, and I began drawing on her feet, Parvati bent forward to observe until our heads were almost touching, her breath sweet with the scent of peanut. Her warm sigh grazed my cheek. "You tell me you've never been outside India, but I've only seen this fig leaf in Istanbul, Lakshmi." My breath caught, and for an instant, the old fear came over me. On Parvati's feet, I had drawn the leaves of the Turkish fig tree, so different from its Rajasthani cousin, the banyan, the miserly fruit of which was fit only for birds. On her soles, intended for her husband's eyes alone, I was painting a large fig, plump and sensual, split in half. I smiled as I met her eyes and pressed her shoulder back gently into the cushions of the divan. Arching a brow, I said, "Is that what your husband will notice, that the figs are Turkish?" I pulled a mirror from my satchel and held it to the arch of her right foot so she could see the tiny wasp I'd painted next to the fig. "Your husband surely knows that every fig requires a special wasp to fertilize the flower deep inside." Her eyebrows rose in surprise. Her lips, stained a deep plum, parted. She laughed, a lusty roar that shook the divan. Parvati was a handsome woman with shapely eyes and a generous mouth, a top lip plumper than the bottom. Her jewel-colored saris, like the fuchsia silk she wore today, brightened her complexion. She wiped the corners of her eyes with the end of her sari. "Shabash, Lakshmi," she said. "Always on the days you've done my henna, Samir can't stay away from my bed." Her voice carried the hint of an afternoon spent on cool cotton sheets, her husband's thighs warm against hers. With an effort, I banished the image from my mind. "As it should be," I murmured, before resuming my work on her arch, a sensitive spot on most women. She chuckled. "So the Turkish fig leaves remain a mystery, as do your blue eyes and fair skin." In the 10 years I'd been serving her, Parvati had not let this matter rest. India was a land of coal black irises. Blue eyes demanded an explanation. Did I have a sordid past, a European father, or even worse, an Anglo-Indian mother? I was 30 years old, born during British rule and used to aspersions being cast on my parentage. I never let Parvati's comments provoke me. I draped a wet cloth over the henna paste and poured some clove oil from the bottle onto my palm. I rubbed my palms together to warm the oil, then reached for her hands to rub off the dried henna paste. "Consider, G, that an ancestor of mine might have been seduced by Marco Polo or Alexander the Great." As I massaged her fingers, flakes of dried henna paste fell onto the towel below. The design I'd painted on her hands began to emerge. "Like you, I may have warrior blood running through my veins." "Oh, Lakshmi, be serious." Her bell-shaped gold and pearl earrings dangled merrily as she let out another laugh. Parvati and I were both born to the two highest Hindu castes, she a Kshatriya and me a Brahmin. But she could never bring herself to treat me as an equal because I touched the feet of ladies as I painted their henna. Feet were considered unclean, only to be handled by the low caste Shudras. So even though her caste had relied on mine for centuries to educate their children and perform spiritual rites, in the eyes of Jaipur's elite, I was now a fallen Brahmin. Okay, so that passage, First of all, it makes clear your question about the eyes and where they might have come from. So in the north of India, where Rajasthan is, that's where all of the silk and spice routes were that all the explorers went through, right? Mm-hmm. So all the European explorers went through that area. In fact, remember, Columbus was looking for India when he found America. And so, you know, everybody wanted the spices and silks in that area. And so we had a lot of European invaders. So we have people like my mother, like me, like her grandfather, who ended up with blue eyes or green eyes. I myself have gray eyes. So that was one thing I wanted to point out in that passage. The other thing was I wanted to point out the various caste distinctions. So even though nobody openly talks about castes in India, you know, they're very much aware of what caste somebody else is. You can actually tell by the last name. So you can tell. Yeah. Yeah. So you can tell by the last name. Oh, I see. You know, it's just like, I guess if you were in Minneapolis and you saw somebody named, you know, Amundsen, then you would go, oh, that's the son of Amund, you know, or whatever, right? From Norway somewhere.
Right.
So it's kind of like that, where you recognize the caste people are from by their last name. And also you can tell by the rituals and the ceremonies they observe as opposed to something you might observe. But in India, all these people live right next to one another. You know, they all interact. They all, live cheek to jowl. It's not like everybody lives in different places. It's not like they all have separate areas that they all live in. But they carry on their traditions, maybe a little bit less so than they did in the 1950s. But it's still prevalent today that the castes are distinct from one another.
And is intermarriage frowned upon?
Well, in many communities, yes, it is frowned upon. And an interesting thing happened last year when I went to India. I did a visit to the south and the north. I went to 5 different cities, and I wanted to find out from women whether they were still considering caste when they got married. And so here's a conversation I had. I'm sitting at a lunch table with 5 women. Some of them are BAs. Some of them are studying for master's. Some of them are getting their doctorates. And I said, all right, you guys, so are you all going to get married based on what your parents want or based on what you want? Well, you know, one of them said, I've already decided I am in love with this one guy. My parents know about him, and he and I are going to get married. He's not in my caste, but I get to make the decision because I have come this far in my education and I know how to speak up for myself. Okay, great. The other 4 women said that they were going to have their parents decide their partner for them in life because they were too busy with their own studies and they were too busy determining their own careers. They would rather have their parents, who knew them best and knew their foibles, knew their strengths, they would rather have their parents pick that partner for them because they just didn't have the time or the energy or the inclination. And so arranged marriages are still the norm in India. They are still the most common marriage situation that you will find. And but these women now, as opposed to in my mother's generation, these women now have much more say so when they are presented with a group of guys to look at. You know, they have the right to say, I don't want to look at that one or that one, but I'll look at this one, you know, or I'll meet him for coffee or whatever. So they have a little more latitude now in picking the partner that their parents might have winnowed down the list too.
Now what
What
about you? Did you have an arranged marriage?
Oh, no. See, like, remember what I told you about my parents being so progressive?
Yes.
Never once did they ever say to the 3 of us, we're going to pick your partners. You need to be this person. You need to have this many children. We need to be involved in, you know, your life. My parents were so hands off. They just said, you guys, you do whatever you want. My mother sister always said to me, honey, you have your own life to live. I want you to have the best job. I want you to have the job you want. I want you to have the marriage you want. I want you to decide if you want to have children or not. You get to decide. That was such a gift that she gave to me. I cannot tell you how valuable that gift was. And I didn't realize at the time how much of an iconoclast my mother was. Wow. And my father. And you know, this book now is my gift to my mother, because imagining the life that she imagined for me, I imagined that for her in this book. And I felt like I was giving her that life that I think she had always wanted. She would love to have decided for herself. You know, she wanted to get a degree in psychology when she was pulled out of college to get married. She would love to have continued that. She would love to have had a job. She would love to have seen patients, let's say, you know, as a psychologist. But she didn't get a voice. She didn't get a voice in any of that. So I gave her a voice through the book. But no, she never, pushed me to get any kind of a marriage, arranged marriage. So I didn't get married until I was 35 or 36 years old. And I married a guy who's a writer, because I love writers and I always read. And I thought, okay, I'm going to write. Now, a couple of years after we got married, we've been married now for 25 years. A couple of years after we got married, you know, my husband said to me, honey, I think the reason you married me is because you really want to be a writer. I said, oh, no, 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 not me. Oh, no, no. I don't want to be a writer. And he goes, you know what? Why don't you take some writing classes? Why don't you, try your hand at it, see if you like it. And I really liked it a lot. When I finally took him up on it, I liked it so much. Wow. And I thought, okay, he saw the real me before I saw the real me.
Wow. Now, you took 10 years to write the book. Did the story change much over that time? Or did you know from the beginning where you were going with it?
I think I knew from the beginning where I was going to go with it. I knew that Lakshmi had a journey to go through. I knew that she needed to also forgive herself for everything that she had compromised in order to live this far more independent life. I also knew that she didn't want to have children, because I think this is where I put myself in her place, right? I knew that in order to have her journey, she could not be hampered by a child. She needed to go through this alone. And so I wanted to have that be a part of her. Now, that does not mean that we don't have women in the book who really want motherhood. We have women in the book who want to have lots of children. We have women in the book who want to have their own life, women who are perfectly happy in an arranged marriage and love their husbands and so on. I wanted to portray a lot of different kinds of women in the book, but Lakshmi herself had to go through this trajectory. The parts of the novel that changed were, I think, some of the complexities of the situations she found herself in. And the parts that also changed were some of the personalities. For example, in the original versions, Hari, her husband, remained a bad guy. And my editor at the publishing house said, you know, Alka, he is too one-dimensional. Every character, if they are to be believable, must be a three-dimensional character. They must have weaknesses and strengths, just like real people. So I gritted my teeth because I just wanted him to be a bad guy. I just wanted him to be, to be the guy that everybody hated. And but I thought, I have to find that kernel of goodness in him, because don't we all have goodness in us? We all do, right?
Mm-hmm. I sure hope so.
Yeah. I mean, even the ones of us who, you know, who you think, oh, gosh, I can't stand that person. You know, really, if we look deep down, everybody has some goodness in them. Everybody has something that we can treasure, that we can hold on to, that we can say, now, if they had more of that would really make them a fabulous person. So that is a change that I made for characters like Hari. And then the ending is different, because once again, my editor at the publishing house said, you know, Alka, readers want an ending which is not ambiguous. And in my original ending, I had left the doctor and Lakshmi in an ambiguous state. Like readers could decide for themselves what was going to happen. But in the final ending, and I don't want to give too much away, my editor said, give them some hope. Give your readers some hope, please. So I gave them some hope. Caroline, did you feel like there was hope in the end for Lakshmi?
Yes, yes, I did. And, yeah. And I wanted to, I had a quote here from Gandhi about that speaks to that, about people. He says, humanity is an ocean. If a few drops of the ocean are dirty, the ocean does not become dirty.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, so
that
people can
so
have
good.
Bad things about them, you know. We let's say nobody's perfect.
Right.
I've got a friend who says, he says, I'm a nobody because nobody's perfect.
That's a good one. I'm going to remember that one.
That's one of his favorite quotes. And so, anyway, but you know, it's true. We all have our faults. And yet, you know, some people are redeemable. And that's the beauty of this, you know.
Yeah.
There are people who are redeemable.
Thank God. Well, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, didn't you feel that, you know, Lakshmi tries so hard to be perfect. She really is trying hard to be this person in this world where she has obstacles thrown at her all the time, but she's trying to surmount all those obstacles. And didn't you feel that she needed to also forgive herself? She lives with so much guilt.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
She had to leave. She had to leave. But,
yeah.
But
yeah.
It was, everything in her culture. I mean, she couldn't even admit to anyone where her husband, that she had left her husband. It was like this secret that she had to keep. And it was very, very difficult for a woman to be independent in India at that time. It was pretty difficult in the U.S. Is it any easier now?
It is a little bit easier, and I'm going to share with you this really interesting thing that happened about 3 weeks ago. I got a call on WhatsApp, which is the app that I use to call India and, you know, to call anywhere abroad. And I got this call, and I didn't recognize the number, but I could tell from the area code it was from India. So I didn't pick it up, but then I heard the voicemail later, and I ended up calling this woman and talking to her. It turned out that this woman had listened to my book, The Henna Artist, on audio. She is visually impaired. So she has a subscription to some kind of a clearinghouse where they get books on audio. And so she can listen to as many as she wants during any given month. And she picked this one to listen to. And so she had to call me, she said, because she said, you wrote my life in Lakshmi's story. I felt like I was Lakshmi. I am 30-something years old. I was married to an abusive man. In fact, he would hit me and then be very proud of the fact that he had hit me in a place where nobody could tell once I put a sari on that he had bruised me in those places. And she had a son, a very young son. And she said, I had to get out of that marriage. I had to figure out some way to get out of that marriage. He wouldn't let me work. So I had to figure out some way to get a job so that when he left in the morning, I would leave for work and I would come back before he came back from work. And she said, in that way, I was able to save up enough money and then go to court and petition for a divorce and say that I wanted custody of my son because I could care for him financially. So they granted her custody, and she is now raising her son on her own. And I went to her Facebook site, and I can see pictures of her and her son and his cousins, and they're all having a great time together. And he seems like a really healthy, great kid. And I think he's about 7 years old now. But she was so wonderful to talk to because she was laughing and chatting, and she says, I have never been happier in my life. I now have the opportunity to live this independent life, and I can do it all on my own, and I have so much more confidence. And she said, when I initially told my mother and my sister that this man was abusing me and that I didn't want to be married to my husband anymore, they tried to talk me out of it because that is what Indian society does. They want you to put the individual after the family. The family comes first, the family name, the family reputation, mm-hmm. the family reputation that will be sullied if you separate or divorce from your husband. The entire family reputation, the entire family's reputation is sullied. So she said that, you know, she really had a hard time finding support from anyone, and she decided to just be her own support. So that's a really heartwarming story. I was so happy that she called and that she relayed this story to me, and that we find that Lakshmi's story is still prevalent today.
Wow. Well, Alka, we're almost out of time, and I wanted to quickly ask you, as a first-time novelist, you're being published by Mira Books, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. How did you make that happen?
Well, you know, once again, like I said, this is a collective effort to get a book out. And one of my, you know, my mentor from CCA, Anita, who had written a book based in 16th century Iran, I thought if her agent liked her book, I think she would like my book. And so I asked Anita, would you please send this along to your agent? And she did. And the agent called me right away and said, oh, my God, I love the characters. I love the book. I love Jaipur. I love the setting. You know, let's start working on this novel together. So she gave me a lot of great pointers, one of them being that initially I had had chapters alternating with Lakshmi's point of view and then her sister Radha's point of view. Lakshmi's point of view, Radha's point of view. And one of the things that my agent pointed out to me is she said, you can't have two points of view when one is weaker than the other. Mm-hmm. Either both of those characters have to be as strong as the other, or you need to get rid of one. So I had to then eventually get rid of all of the little sister chapters, which meant that I eliminated 140 pages out of the book. And I had to figure out some way to incorporate what was happening to Radha through Lakshmi's experiences and Lakshmi's eyes. Yeah, so that's kind of how it happened. And then, you know, the day that Emma Sweeney, my agent, contacted me and said, okay, we have an offer from HarperCollins. It's a major publisher. And I just sat with it and I didn't believe it. I got it in an email. And I just said to my husband, I go, Brad, would you please come in here and look at this? And Brad came in and he started jumping up and down all around the room. He goes, oh, my God, Alka, you did it. You did it. You sold a novel. You sold a novel. And I just met, and he goes, what's wrong? I was still sitting there. And I said, it just doesn't feel real. Like, you know, I felt like I must be dreaming this, right? This is not real. This is not actually happening. And after 10 years, I had a really hard time believing that we had finally done it. But I really feel like we did it. We all did it together.
Well, congratulations, Alka. And we're out of time. You. So thank you so much for being with us today. Mom, do you have
lovely to chat with both of you.
Mom, do you have a quote to take us out?
I do. Some books, this is from Francis Bacon, some books are to be tasted, others to be swallowed, and a few to be chewed and digested. And this is one of those books. Highly recommend.
Oh, Caroline, thank you so much. And by the way, everybody, you can get this book on audiobook or ebook or any kind of a hardcover form from any of your major booksellers and Amazon.
And independents.
Great.
I'm sure.
And independent, lots of independent booksellers.
All right. Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
All right. Thank you so much, ladies. Bye-bye.